Today's episode is part one of a conversation with Tanya Locott, Associate Professor in Digital Media and Society at the School of Communications at DCU. She is the project coordinator of Mediatized EU, a Horizon Europe project that studies media discourses about the EU in seven countries, including Ireland. She talks here about how the Irish see themselves as part of the EU over 50 years of membership. I'm here today talking with Tanya Locott, who is a professor of communications at DCU. And I wanted to get her on the program to talk about her paper, a recent paper, which is called Representations of the EU in Media and Elite Discourses in Ireland in 2021-2022, Key Pragmatic and Identity Factors. Basically, Tanya and her colleagues are studying the stories that Ireland, that Irish people tell themselves about their membership of the European Union. And it's frankly a fascinating story. Tanya's going to tell us all about it. Tanya, welcome.
Thanks, Ian. Pleasure being on the program.
It's a real pleasure having you. So, as you may know, this podcast series is called Decades, and it's about the history of Ireland in the EU for the 50 years since 1973. So, you have been looking at public opinion as well as media discourses of the way the Irish perceive the European Union and their own place within it. So looking back historically over those 50 years of Irish membership, how would you characterize the way the Irish place themselves in Europe?
Well, it's really fascinating. And I mean, I think we're very lucky that, you know, we're able to talk about this on the 50th anniversary of Ireland being part of the EU. I think there is this general perception that is kind of, you know, common knowledge, I guess, in those who study public opinion about the EU, that the Irish public is seen as traditionally being very supportive of the EU. And, you know, if you look at those common measures of support, such as the regular Eurobarometer surveys that are produced by the European Commission and the European Union, that certainly seems to be true, because Ireland continually shows very high support for the EU kind of in general, and especially of certain measures, you know, that the EU takes with regard to its member states. But generally, the Irish seem to be pretty happy to be part of the European Union. I do think, though, that if we look back into that very long history, and we look at specific moments in history, we might see that the picture is actually a bit more complicated than that, because obviously, you know, we have certain moments which, you know, some might refer to as crises, or moments where there is actually certain wafts of discontent that we can detect in public opinion. And of course, that's also true for Ireland. And this usually has to do with certain kind of pivotal decisions or proposed changes as to how the EU runs itself. And in particular, you know, we can look at, for instance, those moments like the Nice Treaty or the Lisbon Treaty, or even the austerity crisis, where we can see that there were certain actions taken by the EU or proposed by the EU, which the Irish public and the Irish elites even weren't particularly supportive of. Right, either because, you know, those were sort of specific actions aimed at tackling austerity, which obviously did not generate the benefits or pragmatic benefits, as we say, for the public, or because, you know, the measures proposed weren't particularly popular. So there is, I think, a sense that that support, while it's fairly stalwart, and it does drop and rise up at particular moments in history.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that, because about some of those moments where it's gone, where it's dropped and risen again. So, and just for the sake of the listeners who might not know, the Irish have a peculiar kind of notion of popular sovereignty in their constitutionalism, So that anytime that there's a major EU treaty, then you have to hold a referendum. And the referendum has to be passed by the Irish people in order for the treaty to be ratified. Now that has, and that's, this has been done several times, obviously over the last 50 years, but there were two occasions. That was the Treaty of Nice in, I believe, 2001, and the Treaty of Lisbon in 2008, where the referendum was rejected by the Irish people. And so the Irish, who have this self-image as very pro-European, in fact, rejected a European treaty on two occasions. And then they were asked a second time to approve basically the second referendum on the same treaty twice. And on the second time, they said yes. But still, that shows a that the story is a bit more complicated than one of just pure pro-European sentiment.
Yeah, and I think the story is more complicated also because, you just mentioned that, in both cases the referenda had to be kind of held twice. I think part of the problem, beyond, some choices not being popular and not kind of seen by the public as desirable, part of the problem is also that while the Irish public is generally quite supportive of the EU in general as a kind of geopolitical actor, it doesn't actually, on average, know that much about how the EU operates, the all kind of nitty-gritty of how the EU governs itself, what are all the different bodies within the EU responsible for. So a lot of that support isn't necessarily grounded in being informed. And I think we could also argue, and I think some scholars have argued, that the same thing sort of happened during the referenda, right? That But part of the reason so many Irish people voted no the first time around was not because they were genuinely unsupportive of particular measures, but just because they didn't know exactly what that would entail. And I think in both cases, we know from research that some explanatory work had to be done, and you kind of like the elites and the policymakers really had to work to explain to people, kind of, this is part of how the EU operates. This is why we are asking you to vote for these measures. And I think to some extent, we find even in our research that that still holds true, where the general mood is quite supportive and optimistic. But when you actually ask people, do you know how X works, or what's the difference between the European Parliament, the European Council, and the European Commission? Very, very few people who are not actually professionally doing this can explain or understand exactly how all of these bodies function. So I think that stems that that explains, how this support isn't necessarily always grounded in being well informed.
Yeah, and just to make a quick kind of follow-up point about the referendums, if you follow those referendum campaigns, often they have to do with there's issues about like about whether there's going to be a European army or whether the Irish are going to force to be legalize abortion. This is going back to before the Irish legalized abortion themselves. That these are the kinds of issues that that were kind of big in the public discourse during the referendum campaign, even though they had little or nothing to do with the actual contents of the treaties.
Exactly. So we see that where there are issues where you, as you say, there is this distinct sense that, Ireland is a sovereign state that gets to decide on particular issues. Those issues are very often used by certain political forces to kind of undermine, a much bigger set of decisions. And I think we see that kind of domestication arise quite often when there are contentious issues at stake for the elites and the public.
Yeah, and before we get to your paper, I wanted to ask one more quick follow-up about this because you mentioned the financial crisis and austerity, and obviously the financial crisis hit Ireland very, very hard, and Ireland was put in almost a humiliating position, needing a bailout from the European Union. And you'd think that that would shake Irish pro-European sentiment. And I'm sure it probably did, but not as observing kind of public opinion in Ireland, it doesn't seem to have affected it that much. I don't know what your impression is.
Yeah, I think that was certainly maybe another good example of a crisis where, or a crisis where certainly, the austerity measures were not popular. And even obviously, even the local elites, I think, struggled to sort of sell them, if you know what I mean, to the Irish public. And they were also maybe unhappy with quite a lot of them. And I think there we could see in the public opinion surveys that support did indeed drop, because obviously this affected a lot of people in very direct ways, because the economy was in very dire straits. But it's interesting that on the whole, you could almost argue that, it didn't really tarnish the kind of overall positive image of the EU, or at least not for very long, because then a lot of the upset that the Irish public expressed also was directed at local politicians or national government, because, they were kind of also seen as to at least partially blame for the fallout of the austerity crisis, but also because, they're the ones who are sort of transposing pan-European measures into and how they're implemented in Ireland. So there was anger at the EU for a bit, but there was also anger at the national government and also at the banks and also at a lot of other different actors. So I think because the discontent was kind of spread across multiple actors, it maybe didn't affect the image of the EU as much as it could have, and it certainly bounced back. And I mean, by the time we approach Brexit, we kind of see that the Irish public is again quite supportive of the EU, and then there's a whole different story from there.
Right. Okay. And that's an excellent segue because that brings us to your paper, because Brexit is an important factor in your paper. So you give us an overview of what you're looking at in this paper, which is it's kind of a snapshot, well, over several months in late 2021 and early 2022 of how Ireland was depicted in the media. Sorry, how the EU was depicted in Irish media. Pardon me.
Just to also give you a little bit of a very brief overview of the Irish research that is part of a bigger project. So our project called Mediatized EU is a Horizon 2020 funded project that is run by a consortium of seven countries. And we at DCU are the project coordinator, and we're also responsible for the Irish research. And then we also have several other EU countries: Spain, Portugal, Belgium, Estonia, and Hungary. And we also have Georgia, which is an Eastern Partnership country. So that makes our research even more interesting, right? Because we're looking at perceptions of the EU in all these countries, elite discourses, but also discourses that are circulated in the media. So we're trying to focus on this public elite media triangle and see how these ideas about the EU circulate, where they come from, why some of them tend to disappear over time and others become reinforced or transformed. So this to me, this is a really fascinating way to approach understanding perceptions and representations of the EU, because of course, media discourses are products of different conversations by different actors. And so we're looking at what research there is already across the EU, but also on each of our countries. And then we're doing critical discourse analysis of the media discourses, which is what this paper talks about. But we're also then following it up with interviews with political and media elites, public opinion surveys, and then we try to put all that, the whole puzzle together. So what we're looking at is we're looking at the different factors which impact how discourses are about the EU are produced, spread, and transformed. And usually when we talk about the different factors, we tend to break them down into pragmatic factors, which refer to interest-driven, rational, or practical issues that impact perceptions of the EU and Europeanization, and identity factors, which are more focused on moral values, emotions, culture, ideology, right? How people imagine the collective entity of Europe and the EU. So the research that the paper is focusing on took place in as you say, 20 across 9 months in 2021 and 2022. So up to March, we collected data up to March 2022. And obviously, it turned out that this was a very interesting period for Ireland, but also for the EU as a whole, because on the one hand, we could still see the ongoing repercussions and debates about the crises that happened before this time. So Brexit in particular, which obviously affected the EU as a whole, but Ireland more so, arguably than any other European state. And also the fallout from COVID-19, because obviously the pandemic has kind of petered out, but the debates about it and the debates about the EU's response to the challenge were still ongoing. But then also in February 2022, the EU was obviously facing a new crisis, and this is Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which ended up producing a lot of conversations in the media and among elites, not just about Ukraine and Russia and their geopolitical impact of the conflict, but also about the role of the EU, which to us, of course, was a boon because it means we had a lot of data that we didn't expect to have, that was about the EU, but it was about a whole new crisis. So we're looking at kind of these several different critical events, and looking at how they were depicted in the framework of talking about the EU's role, but also Ireland's relationship with the EU in the context of these conflicts and
Okay, that's an
crises.
excellent, that's very interesting. That's an excellent summary, and I'll let you catch your breath there after that very lengthy and comprehensive summary of your paper. And I meant to jump in and say congratulations for this project, being and that you yourself being the project coordinator on a Horizon Europe project. In case the listeners don't know, that's a big deal, and so you should be proud of yourself. And congratulations for that. Now, thinking about, so looking at the at these few months in late 2021 and early 2022, and I want to come back to Ukraine, but let's talk about Brexit first. And just give me, actually, before we even talk about Brexit, so you talked about different discourses about whether or not support for Irish membership in the in Europe or Irish involvement in Europe is either pragmatic or identity based. So can you give an example of each of those?
There's actually, I think it connects quite well, what we found in our analysis of discourses to what we already know about Ireland's kind of representation of its relationship with the EU, right? So there is this interesting theme that I think has been spotted by other researchers going back as early as, you know, 2010, 2012, where they talk about a sort of the Irish elites, and I think to some extent the Irish public, imagining this relationship as one of mutual benefit, where the EU certainly benefits Ireland and being part of the EU is beneficial, but so does the EU benefit from having Ireland as a member, right? And so this story of, you know, not just a process of Europeanization of Ireland, but also a process of what they called hibernicization of the EU, I think has really stuck, and it's become kind of normalized within the conversations between Irish elites and the Irish media, and we even see it reflected kind of in the public opinion. So you know that means this means that support has kind of consolidated over time. And the EU is seen as being very pragmatically beneficial for Ireland, you know, because of all the economic investment and, you know, all the support that Ireland has received over the years. But more so, EU institutions are often seen as kind of championing Ireland's national interests. And this was, for instance, very much the case with Brexit. Where the EU didn't just seek to protect its own broad interests in its negotiations with the UK, but specifically Ireland's national interests. And I think perhaps even among those who had more critical expectations, you know, who didn't expect the EU to to be kind of on the on Ireland's side and take into account Ireland's national interests, right, that they were pleasantly surprised because they're like, oh, the EU doesn't just care about the economic side, which is where you would expect to see the pragmatic kind of benefits, but it also cares, for instance, about the peace process on the island of Ireland, right? So it was kind of seen as this dual portrait of the EU as seen by Ireland as helpful in terms of pragmatic interests, right? The economy, the trade, the border as an issue of trade, but also this identity issue, which obviously for Ireland, you know, the peace process and the border with Northern Ireland and the UK is also very much an identity issue because it is also about that long history of Irish identity and, you know, the shared island and the Good Friday Agreement and all of that, which I don't think a lot of the Irish necessarily expected the EU to be knowledgeable about, let alone supportive of Ireland. But it turned out, you know, that this was in fact the case. Right. So just to again go back to your question, right? So these sort of economic concerns and economic support would be a good example of the pragmatic factors, where Ireland is traditionally very supportive of the EU. But for instance, you can also argue that mutual benefit relationship is also built on some identity concerns, like, you know, issues of shared democratic values and human rights concerns. So this idea that Ireland and the EU are on the same page, and that's only natural, right? Because they both support democratic values, human rights concerns, et cetera, et cetera. So that's probably an example of kind of identity. But then again, as you say, identity is where you might often see tensions, right? And this idea of Irish sovereignty, kind of popular sovereignty, is, I think, one of those few areas where we do see some tensions, and I will talk about some examples of those tensions as we get into the paper.
That's fascinating. There's so much there in what you've talked about, and that has inspired about five different questions in my head. One question that I agree with you that watching the Brexit debate as it unfolded in Ireland, there was that, and perhaps you sense it as well, there was worry, anxiety on part of the elites about whether or not the Europe would stick with Ireland, and that there was a worry that perhaps one day at a European Council meeting there'd be a tap on the shoulder, and they would say to the Irish, "Well, can't you really kind of give way on this kind of border issue? Everything else about Brexit has been decided except for that. Can't you just kind of compromise a little bit?" And so they were, as you say, pleasantly surprised that it never came to that, and that the EU, it was kind of like performative solidarity from the EU's point of view. They wanted to show that they could be on the side of a smaller member state, and show that very, very visibly. And so that's just another question or another slightly off to the side point about. So I'm fascinated by this kind of Hibernicization of the EU, that Ireland has a sense that Ireland is good for Europe and Europe needs more Ireland. And I'm wondering whether that's at odds with Ireland's actual kind of participation in European integration. So because a lot of other countries in Europe might see Ireland as kind of a tax haven that's kind of out there on the edge of Europe, that's kind of a free rider when it comes to being involved in the Schengen area, or not part of Schengen, having an opt out from that, not I mean having not being a strong participant in any kind of social, sorry, not social, security and defense policy. Do you think that there's a disconnect between that self-image and the actual reality.
Well, I think yes and no, because I mean, you just talked about this idea of like performative solidarity on the part of the EU, right? Which, I mean, yes, it was in part performative, but I think, we're also just talking like about this very public support for Irish interests and for those smaller states. I think also because the EU does listen to its critics in some cases, and it's aware that there is this debate within the EU about, those very large, powerful EU states like Germany, France, etc., that often have a lot of sway and kind of tend to like get what they want in internal debates about policy and regulations and stuff. And I think in some sense, this show of support was partially to show that no, we do actually care about small member states, because there are lots of other small member states who also have their own little grudges. I think that was really reassuring for Ireland, but also a lot of other smaller member states. And I think also in part it wasn't actually performative, because the EU really wanted to bring the point across to the UK that we are actually a functioning union of states who cares about all of their members and their interests. And you can't just bully us to do whatever you want. And I think it was also really helpful to the EU and to Ireland that the UK was so chaotic about how it conducted the negotiations, how many prime ministers and governments have changed during this time, and where a lot of the demands that the UK was making were just not very reasonable. And where you almost didn't need to be too performative, because it was very clear that what they were asking for was not reasonable. So I think it kind of played into the EU and Ireland's hands, but also it was a really good opportunity for the EU to show that as we saw like in one of the dominant discourses that we found in our media coverage in Ireland. Right. The theme was that the EU has handled Brexit negotiations with care and generosity, in contrast to the UK. So I think also for Ireland, this was also really an easy one, because there's also a lot of beef that Irish elites and Irish media have with the UK that goes a long way back in history, and that the whole situation around Brexit, I think, was also seen by a lot of Irish elites and media pundits as an opportunity to show that, look, we are much better off being in the EU. And look, here's a very practical example of this. Here's how you handle such a geopolitical crisis. So I think this was maybe a bit opportunistic on both the EU and Irish side, but certainly like it was a great example of how you can combine both very pragmatic decisions with also showing that even across identity lines, no matter what other divisions exist, there are these basic values, right, of solidarity and support that are very hard to break down. And I, to answer the second part of your question about kind of, is Ireland really all that all that supportive, and do we think that there is this hibernicization of the EU going on? I think there are obviously moments and situations and areas of Ireland's EU membership where it's maybe not as integrated as the EU would like it to be. But I think also this doesn't really break the narrative for Ireland, because Ireland manages to somehow build this narrative about its own identity as, on the one hand, a European state that is integrated where it needs to be integrated, but also a state that is sovereign and that gets to make the important decisions that it needs to make on its own terms. I think for Ireland, this is perhaps unlike a lot of other EU states, which weren't colonized by a big neighbor. For Ireland, this sovereignty and holding on to this sovereignty in areas that matter, such as military neutrality or taxation policies within the extent that it can is very important also because, it's part of Ireland's national story, that it has fought for independence and it has fought for its own sovereign national identity. And I don't think maybe it's as understood in those bigger EU states, which weren't colonized, but which were themselves colonizers. I know, it's very popular now to talk about all this colonization, decolonization, but I do think that really is part of the story for Ireland. And so it's very important for them to hold on to some balance. And I think everybody in the national political elites understands this really well, that, their rhetoric and their debates have to balance integrating into the EU and also preserving some measure of national sovereignty, because that's how Ireland works. That's how everybody understands how the nation works, how it retains its kind of dignity or its independence, because historically that has been very, very important for Ireland. And I think even the EU is beginning to understand that.
Right. And if you'll permit me to ask one more historical question that's closely related, and it's also related to Brexit, of course, is that obviously Ireland and the United Kingdom joined the European Union at the same time in 1973, and Britain left in January 2020. And Ireland is still in, obviously, in the EU. And many, I'm sure that it's quite a common perception in Ireland to see the whole story of European Union membership as a story of breaking away from dependence on the United Kingdom. And you can see that, like, it just in sheer in sheer economic facts. I think around the time of accession, maybe 60% of Irish exports went to the UK, and now it's more like 12 or 14%. And so that downward trend is a visual representation of that declining dependence and increasing independence of Ireland vis-a-vis its closest neighbor. And that kind of culminates in Brexit. And in fact, there were some elites in the United Kingdom that just said, well, Ireland should leave too. Ireland should also, that everybody would be happy if Ireland leaves the United Kingdom, the European Union, alongside the UK. Now, that was never. There was few kind of opinion makers who made that point. That was never seriously considered, obviously. But even the fact that some people thought that shows that they had no idea just how far Ireland had come as an independent state, then that was because so closely tied to its membership in the EU.
Yeah, I think this is really for me, we talk about sort of discourses as I know a lot of political scientists are suspicious of discourse analysis and they don't think it generates kind of real data or that proves anything. But I think the stories we tell ourselves about who we are and, about our countries, about our governments, about our history, are an important part of reality. And I think your example really, really shows this really well. Whereas, the story the UK was telling itself about itself and about Ireland turned out to be very far from reality. And it turned out to also be very different from the story that Ireland was telling itself about its being an EU member and, its relationship with the UK. So I think, this the representation part of how states relate to each other is very important, because if you keep building your politics and your policies on a story that isn't actually close to reality and that doesn't actually resonate with people in Ireland, then what's going to happen is you're going to assume that, oh, of course Ireland also wants to leave the EU. But what it turns out is that's actually not true, that the majority of the Irish people, no matter how they feel about the EU, and no matter how they feel about the Irish government, don't actually want to leave the EU. Because even if they're not extremely well informed, they still understand on some level that the EU has turned out to be much better for Ireland as a union of states, then then their relationship with the UK. And then it turns out that actually parts of the UK don't really want to leave either, and they actually really want to go back. Like if we look at Scotland, that is very clear, both on in terms of public opinion and in terms of elite perceptions as well.
Right. Oh, excellent point. And just for the record, as a political scientist, I'm one of those who really does believe that discourses matter and they're very important.
You've been listening to Decades, made with the support of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative, although the views of the guests are entirely their own. The Post-Brexit Europe podcast is a product of the DCU Brexit Institute. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano. Thank you for listening.